Welcome to episode 95 of the Robot Report podcast, which brings conversations with robotics innovators straight to you. I'm Steve Crow, editorial director of the Robot Report. Thanks as always, folks, for tuning in, joined by my partner in crime, Mr. Mike Oitzman, also founder of the Mobile Robot Guide. Hello, sir. Little hiatus for me. It's good to be back after 2 weeks.
Yeah, Steve, welcome back. I did a solo show there for episode 94, and then I think we've both been so busy last week that took a week to sort of catch up on the rest of life for a bit.
Yeah,
get back into it.
Busy times for sure. Of course, folks, you know this by now. We're just 2 weeks out from our Robo Business and Field Robotics Engineering Forum events. They're co-located out in Santa Clara, California on October 19th and 20th. We'll have 60 plus speakers, 60 plus exhibitors, a career fair, a robotics startup competition, a startup boot camp for a couple of hours, tons of networking opportunities and all the rest. Really excited for this. Robo Business has been around for a while now, so I think a lot of folks know what this event is about. It's the premier robotics industry business event. The Field Robotics Engineering Forum hopefully is self-explanatory. It's really diving into the engineering challenges involved with building field robots. And when we mention field robots, it's really any robotic system that operates in outdoor, unstructured environments. So we're at that specific event, we won't be touching on anything that operates within the four walls of a warehouse or a manufacturing facility or anything like that. It's really this up-and-coming field, Mike, of field robotics.
Yeah, lots of exciting companies doing, you know, interesting things here. So already talking to lots of folks who are coming and really looking for this opportunity to network and talk and share ideas about what happens, you know, with robots that operate outdoors and all the things that happen. And again, here we're talking, obviously your brain goes to mobile robots that operate in the field, right? But again, we got plenty of companies that are talking about even using regular manipulators to do things like pick lettuce, pick strawberries, pick apples. So agricultural applications, picking rocks out of the field. So lots of other things beyond just movement, right? There's a lot of other opportunities that this covers.
Yep. So lots of great opportunities to come learn about the latest enabling technologies. You can learn from some of the brightest minds in robotics. You can network with some of the leading robotics clusters from around the world. Mass Robotics will be there, Silicon Valley Robotics, Pittsburgh Robotics Network, the Odense Robotics Cluster from Denmark. So it's a great opportunity for everyone listening to come network and learn from one and connect with one another. Again, Robo Business in the Field Robotics Engineering Forum all happens together October 19th and 20th in Santa Clara, California. If you want to learn more, you can go to robobusiness.com or fieldrobotics forum.com for more information about both those events. Later on the show today, Mike recently sat down with Marcus Schmidt. He's the president of SwissLog Americas. Mike, just quickly tease what you and Marcus talked about.
Yeah, a great conversation. Marcus has been in this leading the organization since the early 2000s. And so we just talk about the state of the market now with automated storage and retrieval systems and what happens for warehousing and logistics. It's a great conversation about the business that SwissLog is in and the technology that they're providing for their clients.
So look forward for that interview in a little bit. We do have to talk about the news, Mike, as we always do. Anything happened last week? I feel like with humanoid robots, was there anything in the news last week about that?
On a late Friday evening, even later for you on the East Coast, right? Tesla dropped news about and walked out their new Optimus bipedal robot.
Yeah. And I was actually at a Mass Robotics event in Boston Friday night and got the chance to watch a few minutes of this with a group of robotics experts, much more knowledgeable about, you know, the engineering of these systems than I am. And it was really interesting to hear some of their thoughts, which I'll get into in a little bit. But I think we'll just start. Everybody knows the news, right? Tesla unveiled Optimus at their Tesla AI event. They first talked about the idea of a humanoid robot, I believe, last year at Tesla AI Day. And, you know, so a year later, they actually unveiled a working prototype bipedal robot. Now, it looked much, much different than some of the schematics and the drawings that they've used to promote this concept, which Elon, to his credit, had said it's going to look different. And then they later on during the presentation, they carted out the next generation version, which looked a little bit more aligned with the schematics that they had released. But I think for me overall, super impressed that they were able to come out with a working prototype. They said it took about 6 months of development time to do that. So super impressed with that. But I think it was underwhelming from a capability standpoint. I know those two statements kind of contradict themselves because they only had 6 months, right? But I think just with Elon and his classic hype and trying to market the company and get people excited and recruit company, you know, employees to come work there and all that kind of stuff, I think people were expecting a little bit more from this. But again, I was just very pleasantly surprised that they had anything that was actually able to walk out untethered onto a stage and do little basic hand wavings and stuff like that. I really wasn't expecting that from them.
Yeah. Well, I guess, again, kudos to the engineering team. Let's not cut short what this team was able to do in the time that they had. I do think that, it is a wonderful opportunity for those group of engineers. They basically have a blank check project here. And who wouldn't love to work on a blank check project where it's just, do whatever it takes to get this done, right, in the time frame allocated by Elon here.
Is he the richest? I know this fluctuates all the time, but is he number one right now?
Yes, still number one, right? So, again, it's a dream project, although, the stakes are very high. And as well, I imagine the stress has been very high in the last couple of months for this team to meet a deadline that was not moving, right?
Yeah, no kidding. But you have much more technical prowess than I do just from your days working on mobile robots. But when you saw this, when you watched it, I mean, what were some of your takeaways?
Well, I think, first of all, I don't think that's fair to compare what we saw on Friday to some of the more mature solutions like the Agility Robotics Digit Robot or the Boston Dynamics Atlas, both of which have years of development time behind them, right? So a lot of folks immediately went that direction
isn't that because of the way that they hyped it up,
Tesla? Yeah, well, there's that. So there was tremendous hype here, but we're going to get to see Agility on stage in a couple of weeks, right? We're going to get up close personal look at that machine, which is gorgeous, and it's actually already being manufactured and for sale. You could buy that today, right? Yeah. And what we saw here was the first prototype. I think I'm a little skeptical of Elon's comment that this is the first time it's walked untethered. I don't know if I'd stake my career on the first time this thing walks on stage in front of, millions of people.
But I think that's the problem, right?
Yeah.
There's no reason for him to really make that statement, right? I mean, people won't.
Other than being Elon.
Than being a hype man, right?
Yeah, and
trying to overpromise overstate the capabilities of something, right?
He's like P.T. Barnum, right?
Yeah, sure.
Come see the latest thing. But, we all watched, let's reel it back to what we saw SpaceX do a couple of years ago, landing the first, stage of a rocket back on the landing pad.
Incredible.
That was an absolutely incredible technological feat. So have they done anything new here? I don't think so. And I think a lot of people have already, gone through the technical elements here, other than turn this around in 6 months. And now, again, we've got a company with the manufacturing experience. They know how to manufacture products, right? So I think what we're seeing here is that rather than a startup, this isn't a startup, right? This isn't a couple of college PhDs who just got out of college and, trying to cobble something together, right? It's not that. And kudos to the teams that have struggled and are still struggling to do those types of product releases. This is one of the richest companies in the world, one of the richest men in the world, with putting all their weight behind this project. And, if they can figure it out, they've got the capability to manufacture, the ultimate solution here. That's what's in front of this potential solution. But again, I'll be the first one to say that, and some people like to say that building robotics hardware is hard, but in my experience, this isn't the case anymore, right? So actually building robotics hardware, pretty straightforward. You can simulate, you can use additive manufacturing to build things, CNC machines to cut things, right? And you can do that all very quickly to prototype and iterate. Like, heck, I give, you know, a bunch of college students every fall here a couple $100 worth of parts, and in a month they've got a working robot, right? So the hardware part's not the hard part. It's the software and actually getting it right. And of course, let's not forget the manufacturability part of this. That's going to be, you know, the difficult part. So software
meaning what? Like control software, the vision software, the whole thing.
All the AI. Yeah. The controls, the AI, the perception, you know, the path planning, all that stuff is the hard nut here to pull together. And again, I think that I would make the case that that's notwithstanding the fact that Tesla is still putting beta driving software in the hands of the public with people's lives at risk. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, but the fact is they know how to perceive things, to see things, to know what's there. They've got all of the machine model building pipeline software together. They've built all of that infrastructure already and perfected it. They know how to test that. They know how to, you know, get all the bugs out of that, hopefully, right?
And this is where, again, you're much more on the technical side of things than I am, and this is just where they kind of lose me. Yeah. So what you're saying and what Tesla is saying is that their work in full self-driving and the AI that they have there, they're able to take that and repurpose it and have a head start with this humanoid robot, right?
Yeah.
But the data from the self-driving car versus what a humanoid robot would see, do, or decisions that would have to be made are completely different, right? Are you saying it's really the
right? Yes. Yeah. Now they've got a model. They've got a model what it looks like inside of a building, right, as opposed to what happens on the street. So different things to be concerned with here about what the robot's going to see and experience in terms of walking around an office or manufacturing floor, right, as opposed to on the street, right? So they've spent dozens of years now. Thousands of man years trying to figure out how to identify something on the street, a dog, a pedestrian, a bike, right? Now they've got models that work that may not work 100% immediately on this robot, so they've got to train it how to identify things that it's going to see in its indoor environment, and that has different parameters. But the software infrastructure that supports that, right, the pipeline infrastructure for running the model that supports, that's already in place and that's already been debugged, right? So it's real simple to take a new model and throw it into that infrastructure, which is the brains, right? The perception brain for the car, right? That's already, you know, been exercised, you know, tremendously, right? And so again, it's the analogy being that If I was a college PhD starting with Ross and a bucket of parts, as opposed to what they're starting with, right, it's much more robust starting point, right?
Sure. Yeah. I will say they had some of those training videos or some of the B-roll videos in the Tesla AI Day reveal. One of them was, I think, Optimus was holding a watering can and watering some flowers around an office and stuff like that, and it showed it doing lifting some objects in what looked like some sort of manufacturing environment, right? So seeing it do things like that again in such a short time frame, I think, are pretty impressive.
Yeah, right. What we didn't see is how many times it failed.
But having said that, it looked
it's pretty straightforward. And again, that was the idea here, was to say, this is what's going to be possible with this. And I think there are a lot of people talked about it, and I still question the idea, why replicate a human hand with 5 fingers or 10 fingers, right? Sure. You know, there's maybe better ways to optimize that. And I guess you could say the same thing. Why repeat the human body form necessarily, unless it's going to sit in a car and drive, or it's going to sit, you know, in somewhere and operate. There, again, it's all about trying to replace humans in a variety of different tasks and operations, exactly, as opposed to optimizing, you know, how those things might be done in the future. So it's very interesting, you know, path that they're on. It's going to be fun to watch this evolve, right? And I think that's, you know, an interesting idea. And we can see, you know, I think one advantage that Tesla has that potentially, you know, the agility robotics team doesn't have specifically is that the product team's working tightly with the Tesla automotive manufacturing team on requirements for a robot that can do real work, right? And I think the analogy that I have here is the success we saw with Locus Robotics and Quiet Logistics, right? So the Locus Robotics grew out of Quiet Logistics, and they worked intimately with Quiet Logistics in the early days to, you know, create workflows and optimize a solution that worked for that. Now, that's it's not a one-to-one example here, Steve, but I think that there's something to be seen for if Tesla can work with their manufacturing folks to actually, you know, figure out how to train the robot to do specific tasks, that's going to be a win for them in the long term.
Yeah, I think I just have, and again, kudos to all of those, all the folks who have worked on this in the last 6 months or a year to get it to where it mm-hmm. was, right? Tremendous amount of work. But I think, where does it go from here, right? I mean, how, I just call BS on a lot of the capabilities they're claiming they'll be able to do. I just do. And I know a lot of other folks who are well more versed in this than I am also say the same thing. And it's, I just got the feel that Tesla thought that they knew something about how to build humanoids or train them or the software to operate them. They knew something about all that, that Boston Dynamics and Agility and Honda and all these other companies that have built humanoid robots over the years just didn't know about. And I just don't think that's the case. I think if the technology was at a point that would allow a humanoid robot to grasp a variety of everyday objects, because again, that's what Elon has pitched this as, right? Eventually mm-hmm. it's going to be an everyday assistant that can go to the grocery store for you and get your grocery. I mean, stuff is just so off base, right? It's been tried a million times before. What did they say the price was going to be? $20,000, under $20,000.
Yeah, for me, that's I would call BS on that, because in my experience, you know, for it to have a street price of $20,000 means that the bill of materials has to cost less than $10,000, and you know, in my career, I've never seen a robot that, you know, with that's dysfunctional that could ever have a bill of materials cost that inexpensive, right? We've got the average selling price for mobile robots today, street price is anywhere between, you know, 25 to 30K, 40K, right? And we know six axis industrial robots with six motors in it, you know, they cost start at $15,000, right? Just for comparison. Yeah. And Optimus has what, 30 plus actuators in it. Even if they were, you know, $100 a piece, that's still a big chunk of that cost, right? So you, those types of comparisons tell you that, you know, until when and if this is ever being manufactured in quantities of a million units, right? Maybe, but that's a long ways down the road and over the hill, right? So again, I think that's an interesting goal. Whether that's achievable, I don't believe that. So, you know, those are things to follow and watch, you know, sure. in the future. Yeah.
There's been a lot of articles out there already. IEEE has a great one. I think mm-hmm. TechCrunch or The Verge did one where they rounded up all these expert roboticists who have commented on the unveil. I thought we might do one of those at some point. I think there's too many of those out there now. I will point people, and we'll share a link to a LinkedIn post that I did on Saturday morning after the event. Just, I didn't know how I felt at the time, right? So I just threw a question out there to the audience, and I think it's gotten a bunch of reaction, both good and bad, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all over the place. It's an interesting, fun discussion. I think if people want to read that, it might be well worth your time. But I think stick with this point, there was a great comment in Ryan Garapi from ClearPath Robotics. He commented several times on this post. So thank you for Ryan for doing that. But he also commented at one point on this $20,000 price point. Mm-hmm. And I'll just read you what he wrote on my LinkedIn post. Quote, "There's also lots of credit going to Elon for saying that it's going to cost $20,000, which reminds me of all the 3D LiDAR companies who have been saying our LiDAR will only cost $100 if you order 100,000 plus units," end of the quote. So Ryan has been working on different types of mobile robots for a number of years now. And I think there's so many other things that you can point to where it's just BS, right? There's no way Tesla's claiming the battery can last for a full day's work.
You know, I think that I've already seen that. That's already been dispelled. That, you know, maybe it's based on the power cost, it's going to be at best going to be 4 hours, right? So,
that's what they said during the event. They said it could be a full day, full day's work. And again, if you look at Agility Robotics, which is working very closely with some leading warehousing and logistics customers on this digital humanoid robot, which for the first time ever in the history of the world, where, as far as I know, where a humanoid robot is actually doing real world useful work, right? Their battery life to carry around totes in boxes, not far distances inside of a warehouse, or to maybe help unload a truck that has just docked at a warehouse. They're claiming that their battery can last 3 hours for light duty. So again, based off the payload increase or how much weight they're carrying or how far and often the digit robot has to move, they're saying the battery life could be even less than 3 hours. And again, it's just, that's the state of the technology at this point in time, right? So I think that's where I just have a problem with a lot of this stuff is I think really technical folks can just kind of point and say, oh, that's just not possible at this point in time. And it won't be for, call it 10, 20, even many more years than that.
Yeah, well, and again, I mean, a bipedal robot, for the most part, I mean, still has to servo and use energy when it's standing, right? So it still has to balance, unlike a mobile robot with wheels, which doesn't have to put any energy into the wheels when it's stopped, unless, of course, it's on a incline. So all of those things add up, right? And I think that's sort of the quandary that we have with battery-operated robotics, is there's always going to be a limitation on the time that it can operate.
We will at some point be running an article. There's a gentleman named Will Jackson. He's the founder and CEO of Engineered Arts. They've kind of gone viral the last few months or so. They develop a humanoid robot where it has all sorts of facial expressions and movements. And they've been at this for quite some time. And he was actually at the Optimus unveil in Palo Alto on Friday night. And he got to see it somewhat up close and personal. And he wrote a little bit of a commentary about all the technology that he could see inside of the robot, which I think at this point is probably what a lot of our audience is interested in. So if you haven't seen that, be on the lookout. We'll be sharing that on the website in the next day or so, just to really kind of give you his, again, this is just his perspective, right? There could be other perspectives out there that disagree with what he was saying, but I found it particularly interesting because it was one of the first technical breakdowns of the robot that I saw. I did see, another question that I had, Mike, and again, this is something that you often question, especially when it comes to legged robots, is what was the level of autonomy?
Yeah.
Right. It did very, what is not just with the walking out on stage, I'm going to guess that was entirely programmed, right? You know, take some steps, do some sort of wave motion to the crowd. But with all those other videos that they showed of Optimus doing something, whether it was watering the flowers or lifting up stuff in a manufacturing setting, what's the level of autonomy? Is it, you know, it's possible that this whole thing could be teleoperated, right? And there's not really any level of autonomy. So
yeah,
I think another interesting part of this that I'm not sure anybody knows the answer to.
And recall, Steve, we got the opportunity to go visit Boston Dynamics headquarters last May. My first chance to drive a spot robot around, that was so much fun. But, you know, again, it was driven by the tablet, but, you know, you couldn't run it into the wall. You just came to the stairs and said go and drove it forward. It walked up the stairs, right? But again, their next level of autonomy for Boston Dynamics is to begin to give the robot mission based, you know, traversing through facility, right? Yep. And I would say that they're still a long ways from that, you know, with this, although it's certainly, you know, going to be a big part of their roadmap for it to do what it's promised it might do someday. So,
yeah, I think one thing that I do want to mention, because I think I have been pretty down on the Optimus unveil, more so than you, I think, for sure. But I think a lot of people have been down on it and have said it was underwhelming. And again, that might be Tesla's own fault, right, for the underwhelming event. But I think there was one of the folks who was at this Mass Robotics event Friday night was Mark Raber from Boston Dynamics. And I talked about it with him for maybe a minute. And his overall takeaway was that he hopes they succeed because it would be great for humanoid robotics in general, as in pushing that industry forward. Maybe, hopefully, they can create some cutting edge technologies or techniques to continue to move humanoids forward. But I think his overall point was general acceptance of these things by the public. There are so many Tesla and Elon fanatics out there, right? Where he, for better or worse, they don't think he can do anything wrong. They eat up everything he does, everything he says, everything he makes. That if he's able to succeed with this, or not even, I guess it doesn't even matter if he succeeds. If he's taking this project on and believes that it's a good thing, there are so many millions of people who love him, who follow him, who eat, live, and breathe everything that he does. What will that do to start to change the public perception about what humanoid robots are? Maybe this dystopian feel and mindset starts to shift into a, hey, here's why these things could actually be good for society, which I thought was a really good point by Mark. Somebody else on my LinkedIn post actually said the same thing. I think it was a gentleman from Indoor Robotics, which is making an indoor security drone. So that maybe is one piece that we should hold on to, is that whether he succeeds or fails, or how far this Optimus robot gets, maybe overall it's a good thing for the industry.
Yeah. And again, for everyone, anyone listening that has a different opinion, we'd love to hear it. So tell us what you think. You know how to reach us. Drop us an email. Hey, drop us a voicemail. If you have a different opinion about this, or even just want to share your opinion. This is a great conversation, Steve. And again, I want to just celebrate, you know, the product team for doing what they did, because everybody listening should, you know, give them a clap just for that effort that they went through to get to where they did.
I do want to bring up before we move on, you were saying something before we started recording about what Apple did with the iPhone.
Yeah, and I think there's another analogy here, because I love, you know, I love analogies, that you know, when Apple brought the iPhone to market, they borrowed the operating system from the Mac OS and inserted that, you know, as the first generation of iOS. Wasn't called iOS yet. Right. And that's how they powered that first phone. So, you know, they were able to get that much further, much faster, just because they were able to bring a tested, robust piece of their portfolio forward into a different product area. And again, I really feel that's part of what this team has been able to borrow, you know, out of the actual vehicle. And I didn't realize till I, you know, watched the demo that there was that much borrowed from other areas. And again, we'll continue to follow what they can do now from a manufacturing side, from their battery tech and all the rest, you know, to help actually commercialize this solution.
And see that what Apple did with the OS kind of makes a lot of sense. Essentially, what the iPhone has become is a computer in your pocket, right? Mm-hmm. And again, that's where I just don't understand. You think that Tesla is doing the same thing here? I just don't follow that.
Well, we call automated vehicles, you know, robots, Steve. I mean, they essentially are, right? Robots with four wheels that hold people. They're getting smarter every day. And here, you know, here's a now robots with two legs. Uses a lot of the same core concepts. So Tesla would be foolish to have not, taken what they could leverage going forward, right?
Why are they doing this, you think? That's another thing that kind of struck me is, and he has his hands on so many different things, obviously, right? From the, SpaceX to Starlink to Tesla and self-driving cars and Neuralink, right? He's got his hands in so many different sorts of cutting edge technologies. But I know Elon made a comment that if they can figure out Optimus and get this right, that the humanoid robotics business could be bigger than, I think he said, the full self-driving business for Tesla. Why do you think they're doing this?
Well, why does Elon dig holes in the ground or launch metal into space, right? It's the same question. I mean, he's doing hard problems. So kudos to him that he's got the assets and thinks outside the box of, you know, let's do things differently than it's been done before, right? Now, again, we go to the argument here. He has the assets to be able to bring this to market faster than many of the other companies that are already doing this. So, you know, that's going to, as Mark Raver said, this is going to help push the whole industry further down the road. And that's great. So competition is always good. So that would be my defense of him. Not that I want to defend Elon, but I'm excited that he's in the game. I'm excited that he's throwing lots of money at it. Let's see what happens. I'm excited to watch, you know, the next chapter of this.
Did they say when the next time is that we'll see Optimus? I mean, is it going to be a year from now? Is that the next time we're going to see this thing?
I don't think I remember any promise of when the next time we'll see this. But hey, I will remind everybody that y'all have a chance to see the agility digit here live in 2 weeks at the Robo Business event, right? So I'm super excited to see that up and running and walking and actually operate it, hopefully. Yep. Right. Yep. So again, if you're in the Bay Area and you've never had a chance to see Agility Digit live, come to Robo Business, right? Get yourself an expo pass and come see it.
Yep. So they'll be demoing Digit on the show floor. Mm-hmm. We carved out a space for them on the show floor to do some live demonstrations. One of their co-founders, Damian Shelton, will also be keynoting the show the morning of Thursday, October 20th, really yep. taking us behind the scenes, you know, discussing the enabling technology, right? The technologies that go into this robot that allow it to do what it's done. If you know the backstory of Agility Robotics and their first robot, Cassie, which we'll get to here in a second, and how they've studied ostriches and birds and other types of animals and how they move. It's really the amount of research that has gone into the creation of these bipedal robots from Agility Robotics is outstanding. So
yep.
Damian, he's also the CEO, so he'll talk about a little bit about the business side of things as well, as to how they're targeting these initial applications of unloading trucks and moving boxes and totes around warehouses and some of their other future, more far out potential applications like last mile delivery and stuff like that. But yeah, October 20th, he'll be keynoting that morning. And again, they'll also be doing live demos on the show floor. You can learn more about that at robobusiness.com. But it really was, Mike, sort of a bipedal news week last week, right?
Right, yeah.
Agility was all, or not Agility, I should say. I think it was Oregon State was in the news for using a Cassie robot, which is the predecessor to the Digit robot, set a Guinness World Record for the fastest 100 meters by a bipedal robot. I think it was the average speed. What was it? 20 or almost just under 25 seconds, I think,
yeah.
was the amount of time it took to run the 100 meters. The question that I had, and I don't think I've seen anybody answer this question, and I actually haven't reached out and asked it, but was there a previous world record set by a bipedal robot, or is this the first time that a bipedal robot has even tried this?
That's a good question. Yeah, I didn't uncover that myself either.
That's why we didn't go with the headline. Everybody in the world who wrote about this story went with that world record setting headline, which I understand, it's very eye catchy, right? But I would venture a guess that this probably hasn't been attempted before, or maybe not successfully.
All right.
Or under the auspices of the Guinness World Record company, right?
Yeah. And again, Cassie is like the lower half. It's the lower body of Digit. So, you know, just the fact that the robot can run that fast, that robot's designed for, you know, higher speed gates, which is fun to watch.
I think it is important to note. I don't think there was anything autonomous about this either. I think it was, I mean, it can figure out on its own how to move. That's one of the impressive parts of this is the machine learning capabilities of the robot, right? It can learn how it has to rebalance itself as it walks. Because if you watch the video, you can see it stumble a couple of times, right? Mm-hmm. But it's able to dynamically stabilize itself. But it was being, I believe, operated by a human who was at the racetrack, but nonetheless quite impressive. And one thing to note about their Agility's presence at Robo Business is that they will be teasing the upcoming next gen version of their Digit robot, which if I remember correctly, is going to have different types of end effectors on the end of the arms, maybe more in tune with some of the applications that they're targeting in logistics facilities. So maybe something that can help it more easily or more efficiently carry boxes and totes around a warehouse.
Yep.
And I believe they've said that they're adding some sort of head to it. I'm not really sure what that means. I believe in the past there was a LiDAR sensor on the top. Is it a Velodyne LiDAR? I'm not sure, but I think that was all that was up there. But they'll be teasing during Damien's keynote the next version of Digit, which is due out this fall. So you won't want to miss that as well. Last one, again, we're sticking with this bipedal news theme for last week. And this one is definitely, to me, my kind of smoke and mirrors, which we talked about, was Neura Robotics, which makes a pretty cool collaborative robot. Mm-hmm. Came out with, and we're teasing this new humanoid bipedal robot that they called For Anyone. Again, going with this theme of here's a robot for anyone. But I think it was quite disappointing. I think it was an opportunity for them, or an attempt by them, to capture or capitalize on all this momentum and coverage of Tesla AI Day.
Yeah. But again, it was the simulation. There's nothing physical that they have shown, but other than a set of specs and what they expect this thing to do. So again, great for futuristic thinking, but we'll have to see what comes of this at some point in the future. But hey, the game's on now, right? So
yeah, absolutely.
Good for them for having I guess you can't have a horse in the game if it's got two legs.
Yeah, again, I think because we were talking about it, writing about this and reaching out to them and learning more. And I watched the video, and we tried to get early access to videos, and they said, you got to watch our social media feeds on this day. That's where we're releasing the videos and the clips. And there really wasn't anything other than sort of, it was like CGI videos of a humanoid robot. They briefly showed what looked to be a prototype of a humanoid robot at the end with, I think, the founder of their company. But hey, if they're listening to this and they think we're wrong, and we're certainly happy to learn more. But yeah, certainly was a humanoid robotics week last week. So we have you folks covered with our network of robotics sites. You can check us out at The Robot Report, Robotics Business Review, Mobile Robot Guide, and Collaborative Robotics Trends.
I'd like to start off by welcoming Marcus Schmidt to the show today. Marcus is the president of Swiss Log Americas, a role he's held since 2005. Marcus, welcome to the show.
Yes, Mike. Thanks a lot for having me here today.
Great. Well, we're excited to talk to you today a bit about Swiss Log's business, the type of solutions that you guys produce, and you know what you do for your clients in warehousing and logistics. Very interested to dig a little deeper there. So why don't you start by telling our audience a bit about Swiss Log's business, and especially how you leverage robotics to automate warehouse workflows and the other types of opportunities that you provide solutions for your clients.
Yeah, all right, super. So Swiss Log, of course, is a solution provider in the automatic distribution center world, if you like. We deploy our own products, but we also integrate best of breed products which are around on the market, form them together into one working solution, which delivers the benefit for the client. And then we are really also known for long-term support and our depth in support capability for the lifetime of the system.
Mm-hmm. And so what about some of the market verticals then that you're working within for logistics and automation? Those are some specific areas that you're specifically experienced in or have a large population of solutions?
Yeah, I mean, if I look at the market space, of course, there is a lot of investment going into retail distribution centers, e-commerce, grocery, but there's still a consistent and good demand on the manufacturer side, end of production line type warehousing, which then eventually feeds the retailer for further distribution. So we span kind of that whole spectrum. And if you look a little bit at the different technologies deployed, then earlier in the supply chain, you would find much more pallet-based solutions. It would be stacker cranes, pallet shuttle type application, pallet conveyors. Then in the retail world, you would typically find more case-based solution, right? Historically, convey and sort a lot, right? But going forward, more goods to person, goods to robot type applications, but also applications which automatically palletize and deliver store-friendly pallets to the retail outlet. And then if you go further downstream, then you find piece picking applications, mainly e-commerce sector, but also in the area where individual items need to be replenished to sales outlets. So the whole kind of way through the supply chain, we would serve typically in a good way.
So basically storing stuff and retrieving stuff and getting it sorted and ready for packaging, that type of workflow.
Yes, that is what we are really good at. Of course, important for all of those is software at the end of the day, because a lot of machinery and mechanization and robots driving around need coordination and need purpose. Mm-hmm. So software which understands the orders, which understands the inventory, which understands which part of the equipment need to do what in order for it all to come together is one of kind of the large and biggest ingredients of being a good integrator and solution provider.
Right. So orchestrating all of those operations, and you do that across a variety of vendors' solutions, correct? So you've got partnerships with a number of the leading solution providers in the marketplace, as well as you started the discussion, some of the solutions that are your intellectual property as well. So tell us, who are some of those vendors that you partner with and, you know, to leverage their technology today?
Yeah. So important is that, of course, we have some of our own products, which are what we call key technologies. But sometimes, in order to make solutions really great and make them to deliver lasting benefit to our clients, we need other technologies to be added to what we already have. So we have two partnerships ongoing at the moment, which I believe fall into that category. One is the AutoStore relationship. Mm-hmm. AutoStore years ago came out with a very new concept of very dense storage, which can be scaled very easily in volume, but also in throughput independently by adding a number of robots. And we were the first company bringing AutoStore to the United States at a time that must have been around 2011. And we are the largest AutoStore integrator worldwide. And of course, we combine that with our Sync software suite to manage all of the inventory and customer orders. And we add typically conveyors and other warehouse technologies around the AutoStore application. But that is a partnership which has derived tremendous value to our customers and has been very beneficial to both the AutoStore and us with Stock as the integrator here. Mm-hmm. The other partnership which we just started, which hopefully is going to fall into a similar successful path, is with Berkshire Grey.
Right.
Austin-based innovation type company looking after robotic piece picking and other clever robotic island solutions. So now what the name already indicates, island solution, means there need to be something else around it. Mm. And we have been finding them very innovative and very good to integrate into other types of warehouse solutions, which we already offer. So that is the second large partnership, which I believe is going to take off very positively here.
So automated storage and retrieval systems, of which AutoStore is one of the leading vendors today, is a piece of technology for the warehouse that a lot of folks are either have deployed or are considering deploying. And so as SwissLog, as a systems integrator, you're primarily going out and talking to clients, helping them understand how they can redesign or either redesign an existing warehouse or build a brand new facility, right? So that's really your primary role, is finding clients that need these solutions and designing a solution and then designing, building, and integrating and supporting the solutions. Is that the business?
That's accurate. So what we believe we are really outstandingly good at is getting engaged with the customer at an early stage, understanding what the customer tries to achieve via his or her warehouse automation, and then choosing the right technologies and concept which brings that benefit to daylight, right? So we spoke about AutoStore before. It's a great solution for dense storage, put the person piece picking, I would say, individual item picking, right? If you want to store a lot of cases and if you have very high throughput, probably AutoStore not the right choice. You would rather go with a case shuttle instead. So it depends. There's not one answer which fits all requirements, right? It depends really a lot what the customer's business is like and where the customer would like to go. And as I said before, our pride is to understand customers' business, to bring that knowledge of the automation world into the equation and come up with a design which will have lasting benefit to our clients.
And now, as a reseller, a solution partner for Berkshire Grey, you have yet another capability in your back pocket now to sit down with clients and understand, because, you know, typically a solution like AutoStore and a dense ASRS type solution takes a certain amount of floor space dedicated to doing something, plus a large investment to retool or to design from scratch a brand new facility, right? So talk to us a little bit about going down that path with a client to other understand, you know, which of these solutions might, you know, be the better fit for them.
Yeah, I mean, we have now more recently identified that a number of retail organizations see a very steep increase in item picking for store replenishment.
Mm-hmm.
That comes from the sheer fact that the number of articles in the store, they develop always, so there will be more and more. That also means, given that the store is not going to grow, the shelf space per article gets smaller. And suddenly you can't replenish a whole case into the shelf anymore, but you want to replenish two or three items only. Mm-hmm. That drives an enormous amount of piece picking back into the distribution center. Retailers would call it break pack operation, right? Because you break the pack open in the distribution centers and don't replenish as a full case. And here we have created a solution which combines an AutoStore for very dense goods to person or goods to robot picking.
Mm-hmm.
And we have combined that with a Berkshire Grey robotic pick application, where we now can automatically pick items into bins, which are then going to be sent to the retail outlet, to make that process basically flawless and with a lot reduced labor compared to old solutions before.
Hmm. So tell me, from where you sit, what have you observed in the last, you know, 2-3 years with the pandemic and sort of the change in e-commerce buying habits? I mean, personally, I'm doing more e-commerce buying than I ever did before the pandemic. And I sort of talked to all my friends and my family across all of the different age groups. Mm. Right? I think before the pandemic, my estimation, there was a certain age group that was doing that. And now after the pandemic, there's a much wider age group that's doing that. For example, my parents never bought online before the pandemic, and now they're doing that, right? Yeah. So tell us what you're seeing on your end in your business, and how is it changing sort of the infrastructure to support all of those needs, you know, on the back end, if you will?
So on the e-commerce side, we of course see a number of trends. One, which is going back a number of years, that the e-commerce business as a portion of the overall retail business consistently increases, right? That's clear. Mm-hmm. That's not stoppable. What has that done to the players in that industry? Has done a number of things. First, everyone wanted to build one big distribution center for e-com, which serves the whole country, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then the volume grew and some said, hey, I can be faster to my end customer if I don't have one but multiple distribution centers.
Right.
And then even to what Amazon is doing now, hey, I have a distribution center in each urban area because I want to deliver same or next day. So mm-hmm. that is one trend which we have seen, only possible due to the general increase in volumes, right? Mm-hmm. The other trend I have been seeing is that companies which produce the goods offer them to retailer, but now offer them to the end customer direct. And that creates, of course, an omni-channel distribution network, which these manufacturers were not used to, right? So that is the second trend. And then over COVID, the third trend I have clearly observed is the e-grocery side.
Right, yep.
Groceries were not bought via e-com really before, just from a small number of enthusiastic people, right? But suddenly, nobody wanted to go into the store again.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to select their own grocery, and they accepted that can be done online. So we have all of the large retailers to try to solve the e-grocery challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very happy to say that we have a number of solutions in different sizes, which automate those small e-grocery fulfillment centers close to the end customer.
Right.
And some of the large retailers have adopted already, some others are still looking, but that is certainly a trend which is super hot coming out of the COVID times.
Right, this concept of micro fulfillment, and now it's e-grocery seems to be the hot market there, again, trying to put maybe in the back of the store, existing store, even now reformatting the front of house floor space and actually putting this type of unit, auto store unit, you know, in what was part of the retail space before, but now using that to support click and collect or curbside pickup, those type of solutions. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. That's what we see. You know, the word micro fulfillment was formed originally with the idea of general merchandise items.
Yeah.
That has not come through at all, right? To be clear, that I don't see that. But what I have seen coming through is micro fulfillment centers to pick and distribute grocery items, because mm-hmm. grocery need to be close to the client. Mm-hmm. Also, the time between order and pickup is typically a few hours only, right? Mm-hmm. I sit at lunchtime at work and I want to order something for tonight, which I'm going to pick up on the way home. So mm-hmm. there are 3-4 hours the retailer has to get that order picked. And of course, the easiest answer was, as a retailer, hey, I just employ more people which are shopping out of my shop floor.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that is upsetting all the other customers which are still coming to the store, number one. And number two, is very labor intense and very expensive. So if you have a little bit of volume which justifies maybe bundling a few stores into one location fulfillment wise and mm-hmm. then just cross stock in the store for pickup, then a little automation cells, auto store, ergonomic pick stations will justify fairly quickly. And that's what we have seen, not just for ambient, also for chill, and mm-hmm. more and more also for freezer products.
Right. Yeah. And again, the other sort of downside there is inventory management, right? We've seen some robots develop now for driving down the aisles and checking inventory in the retail space. Yeah. But you can solve many of those issues about what's really in inventory by tracking it in your type of logistics solutions, right?
Yeah.
To know exactly how many parts or items are in a bin, and you know when they're gone. So you can take them off the online store or just say, you know, that's not available right now. Is that, and that's, yeah. Again, you talk about the software that you guys are developing to coordinate all those orders and where they're coming from and all that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. If you look at how accurate the inventory is, then of course, on store level, you measure your inventory in the shelf by what has been sold
mm-hmm.
At the cash register, right? Of that is inherently wrong, because the things will be taken out of the shelf, they're put somewhere else and never be purchased, or things have been taken out of the shelf and are on their way to the cash register and still not available anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's not accurate. But on a goods to person type system, where a bin is contained and disappears into the automation world and comes to a pick station afterwards, software will be inherently accurate, mm-hmm. and the picker at that pick station is guided what he or she has to do and is also extremely accurate. So the inventory level in an automation system is super accurate compared to a normal brick and mortar store, 100 times more accurate.
Mm-hmm. So can I ask you, what I have seen maybe in the last couple of years and heard from several potential clients, that people were experimenting with these ideas of a micro fulfillment center or back of store fulfillment center. Are those projects real? Are they happening? Have you deployed real customers today that are in production, if you want to call it that, with these types of solutions? And or are we just very close to now getting some things in production in the near term?
Oh, they're absolutely real.
Yep.
We have deployed a number of sites in real production.
Yep.
We are building a whole host of additional ones right now to be in production. We have 3 large retail chains which are rolling out sites with us at present. So it's not something which is a future vision, it's something which happens already today.
Mm-hmm.
The largest the largest challenge for the grocery community or grocer community is future prediction of volume, right? So there was a large peak during COVID, and the peak went down by maybe about 20%. And now everyone is projecting it to grow again, but how fast and by when? That is kind of the question. And in order to automate, you need to have a bit of vision of what volume you want to automate, right? And that's where, if I may say, the rubber hits the road for the ones which have a better prediction model versus the ones which are swimming and can't decide where the future goes.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And it may be another question for you, because you, I'm sure, are able to see these sort of trends. What are your thoughts about the opportunity for both brownfield opportunities, that is, coming into an existing warehouse and automating it with additional automation, versus investment in greenfield opportunities, new warehouses, like a micro-fulfillment example would be in brand new building space that they're just going to dedicate to, you know, automation. It's sort of almost a lights out like facility, if you want to call it that, that it's just delivering things. What are some of the trends you're seeing from where you sit?
I see both.
Yeah.
I see opportunities which take place in the former back room or in an area when the store is maybe reduced in size a little bit and an area is taken for that fulfillment. I have also seen add-ons to stores. So you have a store, there's a little bit of land to one side, and you build a little e-grocery fulfillment center, right, connected to the store on that one end. And I have seen greenfields, where there is a distribution center close to a city serving direct to customer, but also the stores which are in the city for customer pickup later.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if there's a clear trend between one or the other. I must say, I see all three models having some valid good foundation, depending on the density of stores in that area, the volume of the stores, the customer predicted customer behavior in the area. So all of the three are possible and are practiced.
And I imagine that these solutions, while they can purely serve an online click and collect or delivery type of service, they can also support the actual retail for customers that want to go in, shop, and buy their own things. They can also serve as a replenishment for the shelf as well in some form.
Well, they could, but they typically wouldn't. So how that works is, if you replenish a store for an article which is medium fast moving, you replenish with a whole case. Right? And the micro fulfillment center would be treated as another store in the distribution network. However, the micro fulfillment center or the e-grocery center will not have all of the articles in the system which the store has. The store has slow moving articles, tail end, which they just have on the shelf, which sits there forever, but they are there. So if the consumer orders one of those articles which are not in the e-fulfillment center, then there are a couple of options, right? Either I'm not connected to a store and I can't offer that article online, or I'm actually piggybacking onto a store and I just need to make a supplemental pick from somebody catching that part out of the shelf and combining it with the other 20 things that customer ordered, which I can fulfill out of the automation. And that we have seen is one of the benefits of piggybacking the automation onto a store, because then you can really truly fulfill the online orders with all articles you would have in the store, and you focus the automation on the fast and medium movers, so to say.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, so it's all a data game, right? Having all this data and making all those decisions about what products to contain in what area of the warehouse. So let's rewind a little bit. I want to come back to talking about some of the Swiss Log technology. You talked about software. So tell us a little bit about the invention, the innovation that Swiss Log brings, you know, to a client that bridges the gap, maybe across multiple of your partners, technology partners, the stuff that you're bringing in house for a solution for them, and where you're filling in all the pieces, and what are some of those innovations?
Yeah, I would say one of the areas which we're specifically proud on is our software suite, which number one is functionality rich, but number two has this ability to easily connect to different technologies and still to optimize or synchronize kind of the behavior of all of those technologies into one system. That software and that knowledge how to do has grown over years and has reached a very mature level now. So I would say that is definitely one of the areas which an integrator who has also own products, but also is integrating best of breed technologies need to have in our space.
So are there some areas that you still think are ripe for innovation as you look across the entire sort of logistics supply chain? We talk about some of the issues with supply chain that we've run against across all markets over the last 2 years as a result of the pandemic, unfortunately. But and we're seeing things like automated trucking almost becoming a reality. From where you sit, from the types of conversations you're having, is there some additional innovation opportunities there that you see?
I think there will be still plenty of innovation potential in our industry. Look, if we go back a few years, this super dense storage, which AutoStore does these days, nobody was thinking about. If you go back to about the same time, you may remember Kiva came out with these mobile robots, which were providing goods to person picking. Well, for the ones which were in our industry at the time for a little longer, they thought that is interesting, but forget about it, there's no future. And what do we see? AMRs are coming everywhere now. Goods to person picking with robots comes everywhere now. I think there are still a lot of good opportunities to be captured with which are outside the normal frame of the established material handling systems, right? I could see probably truck loading and unloading as topics which we have not mastered here very clearly, right? I would say shelf replenishment in retail outlets, not managed, still extremely labor intense. So multi-channel robotic picking of items, mastered for certain items but not for all. How do I then consolidate non-pickable and robotic pickable items best possible? So there are things coming eventually in the next years which will, some will surprise us, I'm sure, and some will be just saying, hey, lucky that we finally got it, we were waiting for that for ages.
Well, Marcus, this has been a very interesting conversation. I think I learned quite a bit more about Swiss Log than I understood before this conversation. Certainly the relationship with AutoStore was one I was very familiar with and a long, rich history with them. But now opening up a relationship with Berkshire Grey, again, one of the leading innovators for what they do and other types of products. So this has been fascinating to talk to you about all of this. I'm certainly excited to watch the innovation. So I want to thank you for coming on the show today and sharing with us. And again, tell us how folks can find you guys if they want to follow up and learn more about Swiss Log.
Yeah, I mean, the easiest these days is just Google Swiss Log, of course. You get all about us. But if you want a more structured way, then SwissLog.com is our webpage, and there you find, or our listeners will find contact information per country and so forth. So that's the best way of getting in contact with us.
And you're a worldwide company, although you've got responsibility for the US, a worldwide company, especially in Europe. And
yeah, we are truly a worldwide company. We have a very strong setup in Europe. We are strong in Asia, and we are well present here in the US.
Yeah. Well, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Mike, and thanks for the good dialogue.
Thanks again to Marcus Schmidt of Swiss Log Americas. Mike, any final thoughts there?
Again, great conversation with Marcus. And you know, I love the concept of AutoStore. Had a chance to see that last year, you know, firsthand at the grocery shop. And he and I had that conversation about micro fulfillment, the impact that that's going to have on the grocery delivery space. And I think that's an exciting, you know, market space that now has matured. And I think we're going to see more and more deployments, you know, in the coming years now, where you'll just go to the grocery store, order your groceries, stop by on the way home from work like an ATM, Steve, pick up your boxes or bags of groceries, throw them in the car, maybe even be delivered by a Tesla Optimus robot.
Oh, come on. Here we go. You're part of the problem, man.
Yeah.
I actually went to the grocery store for the first time, and man, I don't even know how long over the weekend. It was very weird. I haven't been to the grocery store in probably a year.
I still love wandering in the grocery store, just looking at stuff. It drives my wife crazy. Buying stuff that wasn't on the list, right?
I mean, that's how they get you, right? Yeah. You go for a couple things and you walk out spending $100, right?
But, exactly.
Thanks again, Marcus, for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate it. One more reminder, folks, Robo Business in the Field Robotics Engineering Forum, just about 2 weeks away, October 19th and 20th, out in Santa Clara, California. These two events are going to be co-located together. We're going to have 60 plus exhibitors showcasing the latest enabling technologies that can help you build your next generation robot or help you build your first prototype. We're going to have a robotics startup workshop presented by our friends at Mass Robotics. We're going to be running a pitch fire robotics startup competition where you'll hear from five different robotics startups who will be telling you about their latest and greatest technologies, networking, a career fair. There are 60 plus speakers from all different types of robotics companies and enabling technology providers. You can learn all about these events at robobusiness.com and fieldroboticsforum.com for more information. Again, it happens October 19th and 20th out in Santa Clara, California. We'd love to see you there. There's still opportunities to get involved. There's still passes. So if you want to learn more, also feel free to reach out to Mike or myself. There's different ways to get in touch with us. I'm sure you guys know all about that, but we'd love to see you again October 19th and 20th for Robo Business in the Field Robotics Engineering Forum out in Santa Clara, California. That's going to do it for episode 95 of the Robot Report podcast. Thanks again, folks, for tuning in. New episodes of the podcast drop each week. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts, Apple Music, Amazon Music, Spotify, SoundCloud. You get the idea. Please do us a favor. Give us a review. Give us a rating, share this with a friend or a coworker. That would really help us out and get more people to listen to this program. So really appreciate it. On behalf of Mike Oitzman and the rest of the crew, I'm Steve Crow. Thanks, folks, for tuning in. We'll talk to you again next week.
Nice job talking over the dog.
Oh, you can hear him.